times, friendship is one of the characteristics we associate with being human. Most of us have friends, some even lifelong friends, and some have people in their lives that they consider to be best friends. Research has shown that friendship can be good for mental and physical health. Well, scientists are finding that animals can also form friendships and sometimes even bond across species. A few years ago, there was a famous friendship between a tortoise named Mizet and a hippo named Owen living in a preserve in East Africa. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to look at the relationship between animals and across animal species, including the human species. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Dorothy Cheney is a primatologist and a professor of biology at the University of Pennsylvania. She specializes in primate communication and social behavior, has worked for a number of years studying baboons in Botswana with her husband and research partner, Robert Seifert, who also joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's a primatologist professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. They published recently an article in the Annual Review of Psychology titled The Evolutionary Origins of Friendship. And Dorothy Cheney, nice to have you with us, back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Nice to have you back. And Robert Seifert, nice to have you with us as well.
Thanks a lot.
Also with us is James Serpel. He's a professor of animal welfare and director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. And James Serpel, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's good to be back.
Well, let's start with baboons. And I know the two of you just got back from Botswana, where you have been studying baboons. And Dorothy, if I could begin with you, if we're talking about animal friendship, what does a friendship between two baboons look like?
Well, the primary way in which baboons manifest a friendship is through grooming. So two individuals will groom each other. Back and forth, it tends to be reciprocal, and some studies have shown that sort of physiologically being groomed feels great, sort of like having a back rub. And if you study a group of baboons for 25 years or so, you'll notice that certain pairs of individuals maintain stronger grooming relationships than others. And typically, these tend to be close relatives, close female relatives, mothers and daughters, for example, or sisters. But that's not always the case. Even females with no female relatives whatsoever will form a close grooming relationship with another individual.
And Robert, would you say that's a friendship? I don't want to get too, you know, mired in language here, but are we talking about friendships?
Well, so if you look at baboons, as Dorothy says, and you observe their behavior, friendship is certainly a good way to describe it. It persists, we now know, for 15, 20 years often, and it has the characteristics that we associate with friendships. These animals interact with each other often in many different ways, and it certainly looks like friendly interactions of one sort, like forming alliance, affect, grooming. But the other interesting thing is that it's not an anthropomorphic term, because we've done experiments that ask the baboons, do you recognize the friendships that other animals have? And it looks like they do.
Well, take us in, because that's a very provocative thing that you just said. How do you get that information from a baboon?
Well, so baboons make these different vocalizations in different circumstances, and you can design an experiment in which, for example, you wait until two adult female baboons are sitting together and they're just resting, and you can, from your library of sounds that you've recorded from all the members in the group, you can put together a sequence of sounds, threatening vocalizations, screams, and things that make it sound like two individuals are having an aggressive interaction off behind the bushes, and see how these two subjects respond. And if you play a sequence of vocalizations that makes it sound like just any two individuals are interacting, the subjects don't look very much. But if you play a sequence that makes it sound like the close associate of one of them is involved in a fight, the other one will look at that one. And sort of like looking at the mother when the offspring is involved in a fight. And if you play a sequence that makes it sound like their two close associates are involved in a fight, they look at each other. So they seem to associate a particular vocalization with a particular individual, and that individual with its friends.
And can we use the word care, Dorothy? That they care about each other? Because I was thinking, I mean, I was thinking about friendship as I was putting the show together, and what is it that makes us friends with people?
Well, of course, animals like baboons don't have the same level of awareness and consciousness that we do. But you can do, as Robert says, playback experiments, for example, that suggest that animals are aware or have some knowledge of other individual social relationships. And you can also take physiological measurements like stress hormones, which you can gather from the scientific terminology is poop collection. So we take fecal samples from baboons, and you can show quite clearly that when a female baboon loses a close relative, say, to a predation by a lion or leopard, her stress levels increase tremendously. And it's only the loss of an individual that causes these increases in stress levels. Other members of the group who have perhaps witnessed the predation event show no such increase. And in the months subsequent to losing your best friend to a lion or leopard, you can actually see changes in this female's behavior. She appears to make active steps to identify a new friend, to mend her social network. She increases her grooming relationships. She basically expands her network. And similar sorts of behavior have sometimes been seen in humans when they're adapting or trying to adapt to the loss of a close companion.
And we think of that as grief.
Yes, we think of that as grief. And so we can't ask the animals, are you grieving? But we can show through their stress levels that they are certainly experiencing something that we might be tempted to call like grief.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, James Serple. Do you see animal friendships? Is that something that you have observed in your work?
They certainly are commonly reported by pet owners who have, say, a dog and a cat or two dogs in the household. Sometimes two cats also will form apparently quite intense relationships with each other, which are very exclusive. In other words, they don't show that level of affection and companionship towards necessarily other animals in the household. So it's a sort of special relationship at some level, and this is reported endlessly by pet owners, certainly, yes.
I mean, is that proximity? Is it? I mean, you can't. I feel a little tongue-tied, only because I don't want to use human words to describe animal interactions.
Yes, it's an ongoing pattern of seeking out proximity with the other individual, often mutual grooming, like was described in the baboons, a tendency to play together, to sleep together, to just want to be in the presence of that one individual. And often people will describe how those animals will then show symptoms of grief or loss when, for example, their friend dies or their friend goes somewhere else or is even just gone for the day. The other animal will show some sort of symptoms, apparently, of separation distress.
We think of, or we often say, dogs are humans' best friends. But I sometimes wonder with my dog if he's just using me.
Well, with this whole conversation, really, it depends on your definition of friendship. But there are some things that people describe getting from their animals, which are definitely we associate with human friendships, like fidelity,
yes.
Faithfulness, loyalty to the relationship. That's something that people endlessly describe in terms of their relationship with their dog because their dog shows towards them, demonstrates towards them
behavior.
You come
home and they're happy to see you.
Exactly. I'm ecstatic to see you beside themselves. And they do it consistently over time. And this is sending you a very strong message that you are a special individual for this animal.
All right. So are they using us?
Well, I don't think they're necessarily using us. I mean, we're using them, actually, right. I think, in many respects because of this whole issue of stress reduction and things like that, which are now being described among pet owners when they're interacting with their pets.
Yeah.
So you've got the same kind of thing going on.
Well, Dorothy and Robert, let me go back to you as well. And even putting the relationships, even the friendships that you have observed, is it about also survival? Is there something that helps these baboons, in this case, survive because they have a close bond with another baboon?
Well, what's becoming really, really interesting is that the more people engage in this long-term research, not just on baboons, but many different animals, including chimpanzees, horses, dolphins, even rats, it's becoming clear that animals who are highly motivated, perhaps to use you as a friend, highly motivated to form a friendship and perhaps skilled at making and retaining a close bond, tend to have much higher reproductive success. Their offspring survive at higher rates. They live longer. And some of our research on baboons have suggested that even if you just take the mother-daughter bond, which is the strongest, And you divide mother-daughter bonds into three categories, the strongest ones, the intermediate ones, and the ones that are less good. And we all know that some mothers and daughters get along better than others. You can show quite clearly that females with the strongest bonds with their mothers or daughters have greater longevity, their offspring survive at higher rates. And so it's clearly beginning to be shown in a variety of species, as I say, including rats and dolphins. And so, you know, you ask whether or not your dog is using you. It'd be highly adaptive. I mean, having a close bond or having a close friendship is good for your health.
And you want to add to that? I mean, I'm thinking of evolution, how these bonds have served evolution.
Well, that's the interesting thing, because, of course, we can talk about the way evolution fosters bonds between males and females for mating, but these are ways in which evolution seems to have been fostering bonds between females in a matrilineal society like baboons, and the same holds for a lot of species where males form coalitions, and those coalitions lead to greater mating success. There's amazing data on dolphins and how they form these male-male teams, and those teams lead to higher reproductive success for the males. And it certainly looks like in chimpanzee society, where males are battling for high rank, and high rank gets you a lot of matings, that having a friendship and an ally improves your reproductive success. And the friendships in chimps are manifest in an incredible variety of ways. They share meat, they form alliances with each other, they groom with each other, and this, again, can go on for 10 or 15 years.
And does it make them more attractive? I mean, the fact that they have a social network, again, I'm, you know, using air quotes on the radio.
It's... how exactly it works is just not entirely clear. This is new work by John Matani at the University of Michigan and David Watts at Yale, and they've been studying chimps for many, many years. And now the data are coming out that these bonds are correlated with improved reproduction and longevity and dominance rank. But exactly what the mechanisms are is now the next stage in our scientific work.
Well, and we're almost up on a break here, but I'm also thinking about, and I'm looking at you, Dorothy, male-female friendships in the animal world. And because of reproduction, I wonder if that complicates matters.
Well, it does in a sense because, it actually makes it easier to some degree because you can see whether an offspring is produced, whereas if you look at a bond between two female baboons, it's sort of hard to get a handle on exactly what the mechanism is underlying this increased longevity and health. But even in baboons, males and females will form quite long-term bonds that appear to be most evident not during sexual interactions, but once the baby is born, where the males and females will form a very close, what people have called friendship, that seems to serve in part to protect the offspring. And these males are devoted to these individuals. And even after the offspring is weaned, they may... You know, they will be trailed like the Pied Piper by, you know, lots of juveniles who, you know, can do all sorts of injustices to him, like jump on his head.
Exactly. No, what a wonderful image that is. We are talking about friendship between animals with Dorothy Cheney, Robert Seifarth, and James Serple. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Law can be an instrument of change. That's why the Widener Law Program is a practice-based legal education from a faculty of respected legal scholars and practitioners. Classroom learning is reinforced with hands-on experience through clinics, externships, trial simulations, and much more. And the Delaware campus, located in the heart of America's corporate capital and in close proximity to many of the nation's leading healthcare providers, is a place to focus on corporate and health law. Learn more at law.widener.edu. Widener Law supports WHYY.
The Discover Newsworks Discover the Philadelphia Region sweepstakes. Newsworks.org is giving away great prizes to our Facebook fans. This week, tickets to see two upcoming concerts at Union Transfer. Search Newsworks.org on Facebook and enter weekly. Share with your friends for extra chances to win. You must like Newsworks.org on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of rules, go to Newsworks.org. Newsworks.org, powered by WHYY and you. Smart. Local. News.
Today he is a professor, writer, and director, but when he was 15, all Jamal Joseph wanted was to be a Black Panther.
Choose me, brother. I kill a white dude right now. Whole meeting gets quiet. And I was like, oh, he's going to give me a big gun like with the Panther logo on the bottom. And he hands me a stack of books.
Jamal Joseph was the Panther baby. It's our latest Black History Month memoir, and it's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about the relationship between animals, some interesting new research looking at how animals bond with each other. Also, in some cases, bond across species, including the human species. And let me just quickly reintroduce our guests. James Serpel is a professor of animal welfare, also director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. Also with us is Robert Seifarth. He's a primatologist, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. He happens to be married to our third guest. Dorothy Cheney is a primatologist, professor of biology at the University of Pennsylvania as well. And they have been doing fascinating research in Botswana. In fact, I just got back a couple of weeks ago from doing some of that research in Botswana. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And James Serpel, let me go back to you and thinking more about the companion animals, the animals that we live with. And I don't mean to put my animals on the spot here about my dog using me, but I also have a cat as well. And it's such a different relationship that humans tend to have with the felines in their lives.
They do, although a lot of people are very pro-feline and very pro the relationship with cats. And when you talk to those people, very often I get the impression that the cat really does fulfill the role of an infant for those kinds of folks, perhaps more so than a dog.
Well, the size, right?
The size weight is a factor. Cats love to sleep on you, which is a great kind of infant-like behavior. And they can be very affectionate, you know, right, very adoring. But not all cats, you know, some cats are much less so. And you have to you have to accommodate these individual differences, which are quite significant, especially in cats.
Well, even a meow can sound like a baby's cry sometimes.
Absolutely, yes.
And the big eyes as well.
And
right?
Some of our cat breeds we've selected to meow like a baby crying. And I think that's part of the process that's going on there through artificial selection. We're selecting for animals that do this thing for us. In other words, trigger these responses in us.
And these responses, and this is research that's been done looking at literally how the body responds to an animal.
Indeed, yes. I mean, it turns out that when people are interacting with their animals, all sorts of strange things go on physiologically inside them. There was a neat study came out recently from Japan where they actually found that people whose dogs looked at them a lot had higher levels of a neuropeptide hormone called oxytocin in their urine. And oxytocin, is known as the trust hormone, the bonding hormone. It's a hormone that's closely associated with this process of forming strong attachments for other individuals. So the dog, if you like, is turning the owner on by causing this secretion of oxytocin just by looking at them.
Does that sort of fit in the kind of research you've been doing, Dorothy?
Well, not specifically our research, but there's some fascinating new research coming out on chimpanzees where people have been able to collect oxytocin from urine, which is a real feat. And people are beginning to show that if, for example, two chimpanzees who are good friends groom with each other, their oxytocin levels increase. Whereas if two chimpanzees groom who are not particularly good friends groom, you don't see similar increase. It's sort of like going to a dinner party with a good friend as opposed to going to a very awkward cocktail party, for example. And people are even beginning to show, these people working, Kathy Crockford and Roman Wittig, working on chimpanzees in Uganda, that when chimps share food with one another, their oxytocin levels increase. So in some cases, handing over something valuable to a good friend actually is pleasurable to you.
Well, interesting. I mean, it's so tactile what we're talking about, Robert, whether it's between animals or across species or with humans and animals, that relationship is such a physical relationship. I'm thinking of grooming, but also, of course, hugging cats and petting dogs.
And so once you've established that animals who form close bonds live longer and their infants survive better, then that right away means that natural selection is not only going to favor the close bonds themselves, but they're going to favor anything, any kind of behavior or hormonal interaction that promotes close bonds. And if touching, hugging, grooming, sharing food promotes a close bond, natural selection is going to favor that. And that's very interesting because we'd like to know how evolution has shaped this kind of cooperative behavior.
Because I'm thinking it raises questions about loyalty, about, you know, long-term relationships. I mean, what that means for instance, a group of baboons.
And it would be, I mean, it would be lovely to try to study, you know, different mm-hmm. long-term pairs in baboons or chimpanzees or dolphins or any of these long-lived animals and see, you know, what happens when they break up. You know, right. what happens when somebody doesn't come to another person's aid?
Well, I was thinking about, you know, we unfriend people on the internet, on Facebook. Do we see this among baboons or other animals, unfriending?
Not to the same degree one would see in humans, because, of course, animals are probably not capable of the level of spite and vindictiveness and introspection, certainly, that middle school girls are capable of. but what you do see is that, for reasons that we don't yet understand, that some individuals just seem better at maintaining a bond than others. And one of the issues that a lot of scientists are becoming increasingly interested in, it's a very new area, is personality. If we were all sitting around with all the people who've worked at our baboon site at night, say, over a glass of wine, and we were talking about baboons, we'd all agree at some level about who's the nice one and who's the, you know, cranky one. And it sometimes seems as though baboons are also aware of these personality traits, and yet we don't yet quite have a handle on that. One thing we do know is that it's not related to dominance rank.
Oh, so interesting.
So that female baboons form very conservative dominance hierarchies where a female inherits her mother's rank. So it's very much like British royalty. But these social bonds and the consequences of the bonds in terms of longevity are not correlated necessarily with high rank.
Interesting. James Serpel, I'm thinking about personality, but also how that might tie into breed, you know, a dog breed that seems to favor a certain kind of personality.
Yes, indeed. It's a major component, I think, of our relationships with companion animals is this, we talk about compatibility in marriage, but it's also compatibility in friendships. And, you know, some owner-pet pairs are certainly more compatible than others. And I'm afraid, you know, our animal shelters are full of animals where that relationship is broken down for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. And very often, when you ask these people why they're getting rid of the animal, what often comes out is some kind of behavioral incompatibility between the two that mm-hmm. the person couldn't deal with.
This goes back in time, but did humans bring, I guess, wolves/dogs into their lives because they needed a friend?
Well, that's a really interesting question and hotly debated because there's, you know, various different schools of thought. Some people thought they came on board as kind of camp scavengers. Mm. My personal belief is that people adopted these animals as cubs and then reared them as members of the family. And so, yes, I think that bonding aspect was critical to the initial establishment of that relationship. And we have lots of evidence that hunting and gathering people like keeping young wild animals as pets. Hmm. So they capture them when they're out hunting, and then they bring them home and they rear them and care for them.
Which is very provocative. I mean, yeah. Wanting something young and fuzzy in their lives.
Well, they spend...
and tactile.
I mean, they spend hours and hours caring for these animals. Hmm. There have been some studies that have actually clocked the number of hours people spend, you know, foraging for food just for the pet. And they will spend 2 or 3 hours a day just getting the food to feed their pets, which is quite significant.
Anyone want to add anything to what James Serpel just said? Robert?
It's fascinating. It's almost like a spillover to the, you know, the selection for bonding, and you look for anything that rewards you.
And yeah. And the desire to bond, I guess, and care for someone other than what yourself,
mm-hmm. and somewhat to some degree are superfluous, you know, because it's not necessarily directly related to producing an offspring. And what James just said, I mean, in fact, it could be actually harmful to your well-being to spend 2 or 3 hours a day foraging for food. A female baboon doesn't need to spend 10 hours a week grooming her best friend. She could survive without a best friend. I mean, you know, she might have experienced less lower offspring survival, but it's not going to be tremendously difficult. And yet, these animals are willing to devote many hours of superfluous activity and when they could be eating to these bonds, which suggests they must be under very strong selective pressure, at least in the past.
Well, I'm thinking of a line from The Little Prince, something like, it's the time you waste with someone that makes them important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just a great line.
And it's bonds with specific individuals, too, because when we were looking at the data on baboons, you know, there you are, a baboon, and there are 23 other females in your group, and you could distribute your group equally among all of them, and that would seem like a great thing to do, but baboons don't do that. They really differ, and it turns out that the baboons that had the lowest levels of stress hormones and that seemed to be the most successful by other measures were those who had the most restricted grooming networks.
Mm.
They groomed a lot with a few individuals. It's as if the baboons were telling us by their behavior it's better to have a few really close friends than a lot of acquaintances.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce the three of you. We are talking about friendship in the animal world, between animals, among animals, and including across species, including the human species. And Robert Seifarth is a primatologist. His wife, Dorothy Cheney, is a primatologist as well. They've been doing groundbreaking research in Botswana. They both teach at the University of Pennsylvania. And James Serple, also with us, professor of animal welfare, director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinarian Medicine. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Kim from Chester to join us on Radio Times. And Kim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm not talking about primates and I'm not talking about pets. I had a surprise about a month ago. I was driving into work and there were two squirrels chasing each other around and they ended up running in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And being a little bit upset, I happened to hit one because I couldn't stop. There was a truck behind me, and I turned around because I never like to see an animal hit a second time. So I went back, and in the street where the little dead squirrel was the other squirrel kind of calling to it. Mm-hmm. And trying to lift it up, trying to get it to move or lift its legs or lift its arms. So I was really surprised. I did move it out of the street, by the way.
But you were surprised to see one
squirrel
trying to, it sounds like, revive another squirrel. Dorothy,
or try to relate, like,
or relate.
Was, like, upset, like, trying to, you know, hey, what are you doing? Why aren't you coming? You know, it was surprising that there was a relationship.
Well,
like that.
Let me see what our guests say. I'm going to start with you, Dorothy. Any thoughts?
Well, it sounds from what you're saying that these were two adult squirrels. Is that so it's not just a mother and trying to take care of a youngster, and so it does suggest that, I mean, and I think people actually have begun to document this, that squirrels do live a long time. They do form differentiated bonds with just a few other individuals, and it's quite possible that these were two very closely bonded individuals, and this was stressful for the survivor.
Kim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We've been focusing a lot on chimpanzees and baboons, but I wonder to you, Robert Seifarth, about other animals that are being, I guess, looked at. And I'm thinking about elephants, other hyenas. I think there's been some research.
Yes, it's and almost every place where there has been a long-term study lasting 10, 15, 25 years or even more, scientists are starting to describe these long-term bonds between particular individuals that can't necessarily be explained by kinship, nor do they and they persist. And it's not that all animals have these bonds. Some do and some don't. Elephants live in a matrilineal society where the mothers and their daughters stay together. And there are certainly close bonds within these groups, but it's not that the matriarch has an equally close bond with all of her daughters and granddaughters. Some are closer than others. Hyenas live in a much more complicated sort of fission-fusion society with animals coming and going, but there are, nonetheless, long-term bonds between pairs of animals. And the same for dolphins. And what's interesting is that this is cropping up in so many different species, in such a wide variety of species, and it's only emerging in those relatively few sites around the world where people have continuously studied known individuals for many, many years.
Because it seems that at least until recently, we thought of friendship, Dorothy, as something that humans did. I mean, this is what made us human.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But what this suggests is whatever it is that motivates people to maintain and create and maintain friendships is ancient, evolutionarily speaking, because such a wide diversity of animals seem to be similarly motivated. Some fascinating work. I mean, the problem, of course, is that it makes even, you know, animals that we think of as being unappealing suddenly very attractive. So there's some wonderful work done by Martha McClintock at Chicago showing that rat sisters who like each other are much healthier than rat sisters who dislike each other. Rat sisters who are housed together who don't like each other very much are much more likely to have high stress levels, to develop basically breast cancer.
Meaning they fight with each other?
Two females are put together. They don't necessarily even have to fight. It's just that they're not particularly close. They don't groom with each other. They don't sleep with each other. And that seems to affect their health.
Well, I wonder, James Serple, even going from, you know, the wild, so to speak, into the home, into these more domesticated animal relationships, the idea of I'm thinking about how puppies can do rough and tumble play. I mean, is that a sign of friendship when we see the kind of roughhousing that animals can do with each other?
Well, it might be the early stages of friendship formation. It might be through those types of interactions that individuals discover who their friends are, if you know what I mean. So a lot's going on in play to do with practice and learning certain types of skills. But maybe one of those skills is learning how to learning who you can trust, who you can rely on, who will come to your aid, for example, when you're in a bad situation or something like that. And you could see that emerging in the context of these kind of playful interactions that young animals engage in.
And the role that humans play in developing these kinds of bonds?
Yes, I think so. I mean, most people tend to get their animals quite young, so we develop our bonds quite early with the animals. There's interesting studies even that show that you know, children who grow up with pets are much more likely to be pet owners as adults. So there's some sort of almost like an imprinting process going on there early on. Yes, we don't really understand it well because, as Robert said, you know, well, there are so few of these long-term studies.
Right.
You know, people like Robert and Dorothy have done these types of studies. And it's these types of long-term studies that have really generated this fascinating information.
Indeed it is. And let's take another short break. We'll get back to our guests and to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about friendship in the animal world. And our guests are James Serple, Robert Seifarth, and Dorothy Cheney. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Booth Bartolozzi Balderston Orthopedics, the 3 B's, support WHYY. As leaders in joint replacement, sports medicine, spine, and shoulder care, the physicians provide patients with personalized care and the latest treatment options available at Pennsylvania Hospital, the nation's first hospital. More information about Booth Bartolozzi Balderston Orthopedics, the 3 B's, available by phone at 800-789-PENN, 800-789-PENN.
On the next Fresh Air, how advertisers collect information about us with every digital move we make, then target ads to us based on that information. We'll talk with Joseph Turo about how you're being tracked on your computer and your cell phone. He's the author of The Daily You. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The U.S. military had only about 60 unmanned aircraft a decade ago. Now it has more than 7,000. How are drones shaping how the U.S. wages war? Also, debut music from the Montreal-based band The Bar Brothers. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with primatologist Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seifarth. They've been doing groundbreaking work with baboons. Also with us is James Serple, an authority on dogs and their relationship with people. And we are talking about friendship. And we have often thought that friendship is what makes us humans. But now new scientists or new research new researchers are finding that animals form deep and long-lasting friendships, and sometimes those bonds even cross species. Let me get, looks like Barbara from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. And Barbara, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Great show.
Thank you.
You've taken me back to when I was a junior in high school. We had a tippy dog. He was a mixed breed, probably Jack Russell mutt. And one year for Easter, we got duck. We got a little duck.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, we called him Donald. And Donald and Tippy became inseparable. Donald patterned himself after Tippy. Tippy would run around the yard barking, and so would Donald. Tippy would raise his leg to go potty, and so would Donald. They were inseparable, and for many years they were. They lived together, they played together, they watched the yard together. And when I was one of six kids, when we would travel to Western Pennsylvania, Donald and Tippy were on top of the car because we couldn't leave them. And, of course, today that would be something akin to animal cruelty, but it was remarkable. People would just stop, and we would have to tell them these two creatures are together.
No, that's
interesting. And Tippy died first, and shortly after, within a few months, Donald passed also.
Oh.
But it was an extraordinary relationship, and we took it for granted. We didn't know that there was anything exceptional about these two. But they were loving and fun and, like I said, inseparable.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. When you said they were on the top of your car, I thought of Mitt Romney.
Yep.
But let me go over to you, James Serple. We're talking about the relationship. Sounds like a very close, almost mimicking relationship between a dog and a duck.
Yes, well, these have been described in relationships between many different species where if you rear one species in the company of another one, they will develop the habits of the...
including lifting their leg and...
Well, I'm amazed to hear the duck was lifting its leg. Almost everything I hear about animals and their relationships with each other and with people, you know, never cease to amaze me.
Is that right?
You know, it's something new every day. So this sounds not unlike a lot of other stories I've heard of animals of widely different species forming these very intense relationships.
Anything you want to add to that?
Well, and it's especially interesting given that in some circumstances, of course, a dog would eat a duck, especially a baby duck. And yet, in this case, it seems as though the animal, both species, seem to understand this relationship transcends whatever instinct I might have to hunt you, you know. And that seems to be something, as James has said, I mean, it has been seen in other species as well.
Robert, I'm wondering, too, the kind of research that both you and Dorothy have been doing, whether that has gotten you thinking about human friendships or even the friendship you might have with the humans in your life.
Well, there's no doubt that it casts an interesting light on our interpretation of human friendships. Traditionally, the idea has been when people first began discovering that friendships played a role in psychological health and longevity, it seemed like, gee, this is something unique to humans, and it's probably part of the complex society that we live in. It's so stressful, we need friends, and so on. But the fact that, as Dorothy says, these friendships appear in a huge variety of animal societies suggests that it's really a fundamental property of group living animals, of the adaptive value of forming these bonds. And it means that when we look at things like depression and other sort of psychological diseases that we'd like to make better, it's nice to know and to bear in mind that we are part of a larger group, mammals, in which one of the fundamental properties of a long and happy life is the opportunity to form friendships.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's very provocative in many ways. And I know, Dorothy, some of your research also looks at these long-standing relationships and the ability to, quote-unquote, predict behavior, that's sort of part of what this understanding what these long-term bonds are about. Did I read that right?
I imagine it's again hard to show exactly what the mechanism is, you know, and we don't really know that even for humans. I don't think that somehow is a good correlation between a friendship and health, and we can now begin to pinpoint different sort of neuropeptides or stress hormones or whatever that are correlated as well, but exactly how it works, I'm not quite sure. I mean, it feels great to have a relaxing dinner with a friend.
Yes.
It's always more stressful to be interacting with people you don't know as well, which is, I'm sure, just a manifestation of something we're beginning to see is really, really important to us.
But I think in humans, a friend is someone you believe you know you can rely on. I mean,
right.
Part of that is the history of your relationship. Mm-hmm. You know this person is safe. They're gonna protect
right.
you.
Right, and you tolerate violations of you know, you can tolerate a friend, say, borrowing money from you and not repaying it for a couple of days, where a perfect stranger you might not do so. And so I'm sure that there's an element of that as well in baboons. I mean, you can certainly see that baboons who share a close bond, for example, are not hesitant whatsoever at walking up to each other and sort of flopping down next to each other, whereas even if you have a different dominance rank with the individual you're flopping down next to. And certainly with male chimpanzees who can be very aggressive with one another and competitive, you really can see that two individuals who have a very close bond will tolerate all sorts of indignities.
Yeah.
You know, you can sort of take food from a friend, and that individual's not necessarily going to retaliate.
But have you thought about some of your human friendships in relation to the research you and Robert have been doing?
Makes me think I should go back to my high school reunion more often.
Just to kind of see what those bonds are about. Anything you want to add, James?
No, but it interests me that when you talk to social scientists about friendship, they tend to emphasize things like reciprocity. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Right.
And clearly that's not what's going on with, say, people and their pets. It's much more a complementary sort of relationship where you feed and take care of the pet, but the pet's giving you back something quite different. It's giving you back some sort of social support, emotional support. That you want, you like, you appreciate. And so friendships aren't maybe necessarily, they don't necessarily have to be as reciprocal as we perhaps think about them from a human perspective.
Well, let's get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, taking a different look at friendship. We have, looks like Jonathan from Milford joining us on Radio Times. And Jonathan, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I'm a dairy grazer in New Jersey. I graze cows and milk them and make cheese. And I just wanted to share with you something we've observed. This is actually our 10th season now of raising cows socially on pasture, which is very different than when they're living in a feedlot. There's all sorts of well-documented sort of herd relationships. You know, there's social behaviors within a herd of cattle. We've also noticed in these individual friendships, and actually the probably the most striking one was when we first started our herd, we bought cows, and two of the young heifers that we bought from the same farm, who probably were cousins at least, maybe half-sisters, one had a normal tail, and the other one had no tail. It had either been cut off or injured or whatever. And they were Liesl and Maria. Liesl had no tail, and Maria, who was her best buddy, would always graze cheek to cheek with her and swat her flies for her with her tail, which I thought was pretty amazing.
That is
and
pretty-
I, that was the first example of close animal friendship that we saw.
Well, you know what,
Jonathan,
only because I'm feeling like we might lose you on your phone line here, but let me just take your example there because it's an interesting one and give Robert Seyfarth a chance to weigh in on that, although he's pointing to Dorothy Cheney. Dorothy, you want to weigh in?
Oh, I mean, what you say sounds, again, rings true because I was just at a conference about a year or so ago and some graduate student there had who had been working with dairy cows in Germany, was showing quite clearly that cows do develop close bonds with one another, with differentiated bonds, and that if a cow who had a good friend, essentially, who was moved to another pasture, her stress levels, her glucocorticoids levels increased tremendously. So even, you know, a herd living animal, like a cow who's sort of in a pasture with many other cows, is going to have, it looks like, a close, you know, differentiated close bonds with particular other cows.
Yeah, and just I'm thinking about that cow herd, Robert, as a kind of hierarchy, I guess. But within that hierarchy, the ability to form some kind of a bond with another cow, as Jonathan describes.
I mean, so all of our lives, we've been going out to the field and watching baboons, and we recognize them as individuals. We give them names. We take detailed data on their behavior, and many of people say, how odd. But you wouldn't find that opinion from an African pastoralist.
No.
The Maasai, for example, or the Botswana in Botswana, both of them think that it is perfectly normal to look at animals because they live with cows. And they think of them as individuals, and they think of them as individuals with relationships, and they really take those relationships into account because that's their lifeblood.
Well, and James Serple, that's what we do with our companion animals, yeah?
Absolutely. Or indeed in, you know, farmers who use more extensive systems of raising their animals, where the animals are reared on pasture and have the opportunity to form these kinds of relationships. So the farmer's going to see that, just like the Maasai in Africa.
Right. Let me see what – thanks for the call, Jonathan. Let's see what Kate from Paoli has to say. And, Kate, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
And hello to your guests.
Hi.
This is such an interesting topic.
Thank you.
I have, over the years, had a pack of Labradors at one time numbering 5. And I say pack. I have a second job as a dog trainer, and I thoroughly believe in the pack mentality when you have that many dogs, and I respect it deeply. I've always emphasized in my life and to students that the pack works a certain way. You have an alpha dog, and the teaching goes on within the pack in the house to establish a certain hierarchy. Recently,
Kate, if you don't mind, only because I'm looking at the clock, do you have a question for our guests?
The quick question is,
okay.
Last week or a week and a half ago, one of my dogs died, and her closest friend within the pack has been absolutely desolate. She is trying to turn to my children, who I think she views as littermates, for some type of relief from her sadness.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you had any comments on that.
Well,
About, again, as a cross-species, perhaps, relationship, and also in dogs missing their companions within a pack or within just the home,
sure.
How long does it take for a companion animal to recover from this kind of loss?
Well, we're sorry to hear about that loss, Kate. And actually, James Serbal, I'm going to start with you.
I think it varies greatly between, you know, different animals. Some animals will recover more quickly than others. Some will lose a companion and apparently not register its loss. You even hear stories, actually, of animals kind of flowering when they lose a companion. In other words, it suggests that the companion was kind of suppressing them when it was alive, and then it dies, and the other one suddenly develops a personality and is much happier. So it's really hard to predict who's going to develop these kinds of issues, and it's rather hard to, I'm sorry to say, to predict how long it could last. I think all you can do is be as supportive as you can and hope that the dog gets over it.
But are we talking about grief here? I mean, that a dog is grieving.
Again, it depends how you define grief. We don't know what's going on exactly in the head of the dog, but we will see. I'm sure you would see signs of, for example, increases in glucocorticoid secretion in the dog that's lost a very, a friend.
But I would think comfort from a child, someone else in the family, would help this dog.
Well, it sounds like the dog is looking for it as well. It's seeking an alternative companion.
Dorothy, you
and that's exactly
that?
What you see in humans and baboons as well. That somebody, if you're adapting well in a sense to grief, you will seek out other individuals. It's the individuals who retreat and withdraw and isolate themselves who tend to respond less well in humans and in other animals. And the fact that, as James says, there are so much variation in response to the loss of a companion, again, brings it home all the more that these sorts of friendships we see in animals are very much like humans. Mm. It's not just one set response to grief or to the death of a close companion.
And we're almost out of time here, but Robert, I'd love to have you just describe for our listeners where you go in Botswana.
We've been working since 1992 in the Okavango Delta of Botswana. It's a beautiful area in northwest Botswana, a fabulous tourist destination. And we've been following a group of baboons there for a long time. We took over the project in the early 1990s from Professor Bill Hamilton, now dead, who was at the University of California, Davis. So we have this extensive record of the relationships among individuals. And it's these kinds of long-term studies that just involve scientists going out and meticulously taking data on what animals do over long periods of time that's yielding these kinds of results. I will say that this is just the kind of research that NIH and NSF are impatient with, and they don't support because they want answers.
Now.
They want answers in 6 months.
You
want
to say something, Dorothy?
I was going to chime in and sort of... that this is a sort of research that seems to be dying in many respects.
But because of the impatience.
Yeah, because of you want a quick turnaround. You want results.
Well, I hope not, because it's fascinating and important. And all three of you have been guests on Radio Times in the past, and it's great to have the three of you together. Dorothy Cheney, Robert Seyfarth, and James Serple, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder with Jonathan Bess. Emily Bryant is the Radio Times intern, and Kevin Griffin, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. And do say